KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. We're going to take a look at the life of the radio announcer. We're also going to talk about television's past and future. Mostly its future. We want to know what your favorite shows are coming up. We're taking a little light and easy this second hour of the program, thinking about how the economy is usually judged by the strength of its retail. And, you know, you've heard that, well, kind of okay. People were turning out, but it wasn't great. You know where people are really turning out for retail? Russia, in Moscow, where they're building malls. 82 in Moscow, and including two of the largest in all of Europe, with the help of IKEA, by the way. Andrew Kramer is a reporter in the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times. Maybe you saw his article in the Times. Malls blossom in Russia with a middle class. Joins us on the phone. Andrew Kramer, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You know, I really was fascinated by the article, but I just have to say I loved the writing that you did in this article, and I was especially enjoyed, and I just want to share it because it was so great. As American malls dotter into old age, gap-toothed with vacancies, Russia's shopping centers are just now blossoming in their boom years. Gap-toothed with vacancies. That's exactly what a lot of our malls do look like these days. That was a nice image. Scary, but nice.
Thank you. It's certainly something you notice when you visit an American mall. There'll be vacancies, and oftentimes the tenants will move down market as foot traffic falls off. And malls, frankly, can be a sorry sight in the United States, which you don't see yet in Russia.
No. In Russia, you have written about shoppers who are joyful at finding Russian malls. Describe this one mega Belaya Dacha mall.
Yes, the Belaya Dacha mall. Gotcha. It's outside of the city. You have to get there on a bus if you don't have a car. And when you approach, it's in a field and all covered in snow, several large buildings, and vast parking lots, something like a small town. It's really quite an extraordinary sight how large this facility is. I think that on a typical day you might have tens of thousands of people cramming into this building with many four anchor tenants and 200 stores. So a very, very large mall.
Now, you mentioned that these malls are a little different than American malls in that the anchor tenants are often big grocery stores. Why is that?
Well, it's a peculiarity of Russian malls. One reason is it's difficult for people to find groceries in their neighborhoods. There are not very many supermarkets. And there's also the idea that Russians are just thrilled by finding a huge selection of groceries, and they're willing to travel a long distance to shop for them. It's a sign of the difficult times they've been through in the past decades that somebody would be willing to travel by bus or by car for an hour or more to shop for groceries.
What else are in these malls? What's in the Mega Tyopoli Stan shopping center? Would I be familiar with the stores?
I think you would, and that's really what's remarkable, is that a middle class is bulging up in Russia now, and you think of Russian wealth, and you think of oligarchs and luxury goods like maybe a Louis Vuitton or a Gucci shop. But in the past few years, stores that people would be more familiar with, such as the Gap or Banana Republic, are now flourishing in Russia. And you'll find these stores at the mall you mentioned, Tyopoli Stan. Not sure if these precise stores are there, but there are certainly many Gaps and Banana Republics in Moscow.
And people are buying. People aren't just wandering these warmer places in the winter. They're buying as well.
Absolutely. The average ticket or the amount of money that a customer spends in a mall is higher in Moscow than it is in the United States, according to investors and companies that develop malls. I spoke with a number of investors Morgan Stanley, for example, recently paid $1 billion for one mall, $1.1 billion for a single mall in St. Petersburg. And obviously, Morgan Stanley had done its homework. And what you see when you look at the behavior of Russians when they go to the mall is that they spend.
Andrew Kramer is a New York Times reporter in Moscow. Malls blossom in Russia with a middle class is his article. It was in the paper. You know, is there a political aspect to this story? In other words, is this a middle class that tells us something about Russia's evolving political system?
There is, absolutely. The middle class is a new phenomenon in Russia. Over the past decade, it came about largely thanks to trickle-down oil money. And what we had last winter in Moscow and other large cities was a middle-class revolt against the government of President Vladimir Putin. You had a lot of protesters coming out in the streets who were not protesting their economic circumstances, but their political circumstances. And one of the reasons they started to demand a fair political system was because they had more at stake in their own lives. They had now a property, income, and a middle-class lifestyle. And the malls that you see in Russia, think what you may of this sort of rampant consumerism, they're an indication of this rising middle class, which has very deep and profound political implications.
Vladimir Putin needs to maybe shop in a few malls himself to understand what's happening with his country.
I'm not sure that he's ever been to a mall.
No, he probably sends someone. Who is building these malls? Who are the investors?
Well, strangely, IKEA is a major investor in malls, not only in their own furniture stores, but also in malls in Russia. They have 14 malls. A number of local developers have been involved. And now what you're seeing is the malls that were developed over the past decade are changing hands so that outside investors are coming in and buying out the developers. And you have private equity firms looking at deals. Blackstone is said to be looking at deals in Russia. Morgan Stanley has one major deal. They're also close to making another purchase of a mall. The sovereign wealth funds are coming in and buying malls in Russia. The sovereign wealth fund of Azerbaijan just last month bought a small mall in Moscow. So really, a wide range of investors are waking up and noticing just how lucrative these properties are.
Are they fun? In America, of course, malls have been turned into places where we go to also be entertained, not just with movie theaters, but, you know, Mall of America has a big theme park. Are the malls in Russia moving in that direction?
Yes, they are. They're fun in their own way. I think one of the distinguishing features of Russian malls, you'll find many grandparents with their grandchildren because grandparents are the primary child care provider in Russia. And malls are a place where it turns out a lot of Russian grandparents like to go with their grandchildren. There's activities, ice rinks, there's a carousel in one mall, movie theaters, toy stores, and beyond all that, it's warm inside in the wintertime.
Yeah, that seems very important. That was part of your story, but also it seems like that would be, as with malls in northern parts of the U.S., that would be important, be able to be warm.
Yeah, it is. It's also one of the reasons why there's discussion of whether strip malls and discount outlet villages will be successful in Russia. Although obviously they've succeeded in colder parts of North America, but this is one of the discussions about the future of these shopping centers in Russia, whether they'll go the way that that retail went in the United States with the revival of downtown shopping and other types of retail like big boxes that caused the decline of the golden age of malls in the United States.
You know, you mentioned that people have to take buses to some of these malls. They're on the outskirts of cities. Are the malls built as in the U.S. with vast acres of parking lots and people can drive from all over and park there?
Yes, they are. They're surrounded by panoramic scenes of concrete and parking spaces. They're quite impressive in their size. One distinguishing feature in Moscow in particular, however, is that malls tend to be higher. In the U.S., a typical mall will be two stories tall, whereas in Russia it might be four or even five stories, which is a consequence of real estate being more expensive, that they build higher because of that. But otherwise, it's very similar to an American mall with an anchor tenant, or perhaps three or four anchor tenants, and then gallery space connecting these that direct the foot traffic past lots of retail.
Well, it sounds like it's covering this story. It was just like being in the U.S., just like being at home.
Yeah, in certain ways, it was. One other feature of shopping in Russia is people are willing to spend quite a bit of money. I was intrigued to find that a Venti coffee drink at Starbucks here can cost more than $8. So they're very expensive items on sale at Russian malls.
Well, we'll look to see if the next time there's a middle-class protest against Vladimir Putin's government, if people will be protesting from the malls. That'll tell us even more. All right. Andrew Kramer, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I appreciate you talking to us. The boom in Russia's mall economy. Andrew E. Kramer is a reporter in the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times. Malls blossom in Russia with the middle class. It was in the New York Times on January 2nd. This is Weekday.
Later today, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jared Diamond. In his latest book, he explores what we can learn from traditional societies. It's called The World Until Yesterday. Jared Diamond sits down with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, food allergies and sensitivities, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized treatment options at IBSTreatmentCenter.com or on Facebook.
We have sunny skies and 37 degrees in the U District. We're expecting sun all day, the high getting up to 43. It's going to be cloudy tonight with a chance of rain, the low in the mid-40s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow, chance of rain in the morning, the high in the mid-40s.
And now we're going to turn to television. Oh, I know. Some of you say, I don't watch television. But I think a lot of us do, because after all, it still is there. In many, many more platforms, you can choose to find your favorite shows. Melanie McFarland has been TV editor at imdb.com since 2008. She was the TV gal at the Seattle PI for 5 years before that. And you still look good having been studying television. It did not rot your brain. It did not distort anything.
I've got to say, the thing about television is that you can choose to see some really amazing, thought-provoking content if you want to, or you can watch Cheaters and The Bachelor. So, I mean, it's really up to you. And I'm always surprised at how many people say they don't watch TV and then don't want me to spoil them for men or something.
Right, because that's not TV.
DVD. That's right.
Because that's a DVD.
A DVD, or they're streaming it on Netflix.
Right.
That's not television.
Yeah. And yet, really...
So own up to it, people. You're watching TV.
TV is... whatever we're calling it, it's everywhere now.
Yes.
I mean, you can see it in so many different platforms.
Absolutely.
And
you watch it on your phone.
Yeah, and I have been known to do that. And you can watch it, as you say, you can choose DVDs, you can do it Netflix, you can do YouTube. YouTube has created a whole new area where new TV is being offered up and produced.
Absolutely. There are entire channels now, some of them sponsored by some producers with deep pockets. There have been a couple of really interesting things going on. And of course, at this moment, I'm blanking on the title, but there's actually an entire YouTube channel dedicated towards stories of women. And you've seen actors such as Jennifer Beals and, some other very very well-known actors who are lending their talents to these stories.
And these are decent quality with good good production.
Yeah, they are.
So it is.
And they have a following.
It is television.
Yeah, except it's on YouTube.
Yeah, except it's on YouTube. Yeah. Which, don't you think, from somebody who writes about it from IMDb's perspective, don't you think that 5 years from now, those distinctions will even be more diffuse?
Absolutely. I mean, if you consider that right now, if you look at a platform like Netflix, which granted, you know, it streams through, you can get it through a website, it streams through to your television, but this is where you're going to see new episodes of Arrested Development when they are finally ready to go. So these are all these different mediums that are offering what we consider to be TV content. I think after a while, it may be that TV is the same kind of thing as KFC, which is, it used to be Kentucky Fried Chicken. Now we just know it is KFC.
Yeah, TV. Well, and by the same token, right, look at all the people who have migrated, not just actors, but directors, right, and producers who migrated to TV and bring us great stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, well, on that note, we asked some people to put up some Facebook posts. I'll read there. Your favorite shows, what you're watching, what you're tracking. Also at the weekday at KUOW.org email, I want to read some of you, and we'll take some calls in a little bit as well to get your thoughts. But I would like to start with what you're thinking about. And apparently most people are thinking about Downton Abbey because NPR had a story on it this morning. We had a promo on it. Every time I turn around, somebody says, oh, people who I am surprised that are watching television go, no, I'm waiting for that show. I'm waiting for the new season. Here's just a little clip.
How much money are we talking about?
A lot.
Nothing succeeds like excess. I would do anything for this family.
It's the stuff of dreams.
I'll make him sorry.
Starts the 6th. You watch Downton Abbey?
Oh, I do, religiously. And I've actually seen the upcoming season.
Okay, good. Spoiler,
and then again, you know, so is Britain. So.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's one of the big issues right now with a lot of American viewers is they're wondering why it is that Britain gets to see it so far ahead of American audiences.
Well, welcome to what the British have dealt with for years with American television.
Exactly.
Right?
But somehow, you know, the producers of Doctor Who have made it work. We get to see the Christmas special simultaneously in a very short amount of time, if any, between new seasons when those are aired. I think that PBS is trying to iron that out so that there is a shorter wait time. But especially since with this season there were some major spoilers, I'm not going to spoil anything for you.
PBS is lucky to have this show.
Oh my goodness. Masterpiece is lucky to have this show. Keep in mind that for years and years, Masterpiece went on and did not have any kind of major funding. And I think major funders came in either right before, right when Downton was beginning to air. But this certainly helps. So yes, this is a big feather in PBS's cap. And I think between this and Sherlock, you're going to see a lot more people turning to PBS and really trying to look at it. I think PBS is really trying to get back to its kind of glory days when you had massive audiences tuning in for big event programming, like you know, if you thought of like way back with I, Claudius. And
do they help? Do they help pay for Downton Abbey?
Well,
does some of that money go to help support it in its production or just in its purchase? Do you know?
I don't know that for sure. I do know that Carnival is the major funder for Masterpiece.
Ah,
so yeah, that's the main funder. Before it was, oh my goodness,
different trusts.
And of course, I believe it was ExxonMobil.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
No, that's right. So they need to have those shows in order to survive into what looks to be a budget cutting cycle coming up. Does something like
PBS is always under the knife in Congress.
Does Sherlock also bring in a lot of viewers for them?
Oh, yes. I mean, and between the fact that Sherlock was already quite popular, the popularity of the character in popular culture, and the fact that I almost called him his nickname, Benedict Cumberbatch, quite the huge star, only going to be bigger this summer because he is the main antagonist in the new Star Trek film.
Yeah. Well, and Dr. Watson is the Hobbit.
Right, exactly. Martin Freeman.
Mm-hmm. So have you seen any of those? Any of the Sherlocks?
Oh my goodness, Sherlock is another wonderful, wonderful series, and I think it's one of those series where I realize that it's probably best in the amount that we're given, which is, you know, I think it's last, I want to say last season was 4 episodes.
Was it that many?
Yeah, but at the same time, you always want to see more. Because they are so well done.
Now, do you watch the American modernized Sherlock?
I have.
What's that
Lucy
show
called? Lucy Liu Elementary on CBS.
Right.
It's a CBS show. I mean, if you think about it, CBS is most of its crime programming is really built on the Sherlock model. It has been for quite some time. If you look at The Mentalist, the Mentalist is essentially Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it fits in very, very well with that whole stable of programming. I think Johnny Lee Miller is kind of a nice CBS softer touch on the character. I like the turn with Lucy Liu as Watson. I find it very interesting that there are a lot of people who are such fans of their chemistry that they want a relationship between the two of them. But I think as it stands, you know, keep in mind we're barely through half of the first season. I think that their relationship as it is, as this kind of contentious platonic relationship, is really the best thing for it right now.
Boy, no Watson Holmes relationship. Though I know I think there was a movie that posited a Watson Holmes relationship.
Oh, there's, yes.
Back in the past.
Yes.
I watched that show.
So what do you think of Elementary?
I he's a little over the top for me as a drug addict, but I do enjoy it.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the thing is, with a lot of first-year programming, and I would say this more so with network than some cable shows, there's still a lot of breaking in of the character.
Interesting.
I think that network shows generally have a lot more, input coming in from the top about writing and character development. And so if you look at later seasons of a successful show and then go back and watch a show in its first season, again, you'll see major changes, I think, in most cases.
I think Lucy Liu's a producer on that show, so she might mm-hmm. have some input into that. She's one of the powerful people of Hollywood, because they made so much money on the Charlie's Angels franchise.
Yes, but the thing is that even though Lucy Liu is a producer, she still has to take cues from the people who are actually in the offices of CBS saying, you know, I watched the dailies of this, and I've decided that in this scene there needs to be a little bit more of this or less of this.
A blue scarf instead of a red one.
Yeah, or something just very small details.
I find that fascinating that the networks still have that power, even though their universe has been tightened, more constrained, the network still wield that power.
Oh, of course.
Shows.
These are products that they have to sell to millions upon millions of people. I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of cables, there are a lot of producers that would rather work on cable, depending on the network. I think a network like FX has a lot more daring programming because the people at the top are much more likely to, once they pick up a show, have trust in the auteur's vision. And let it go forward and just let the numbers speak for themselves.
Boy, you can sure get lost in all the different networks. What's on FX? I don't even know if I should ask you this. Will you remember? What's on FX that is particularly innovative or interesting?
Well, there's one show coming up called The Americans, which is incredibly interesting. It's going to be coming up at the end of January. I just watched the pilot last night.
Did you like it?
You know, I did. I think that one thing that's great about FX is that they are able to pick these pilots that really start out strong. There are moments in The Americans that kind of harken back to the first moments that I saw of The Riches. There are a couple of parallels there in that The Americans is about a couple of sleeper spies who are KGB. It's set in the 80s.
Well, you remember that was and based on, or at least somebody had the idea from a true story.
Right, yeah. And it stars Carrie Russell, who, even if you don't watch TV, you may remember that she is associated with the old WB show Felicity.
Oh, yeah.
And
I see
this
her
is
picture
a,
now. I recall.
Oh, yes. And this role for her is a big break from that character because where Felicity was very hopeful and dreamy and positive, her character in The Americans is very cold and calculating and really devoted to a singular vision, which makes things difficult for her husband. And you could put that in quotes because they're actually a pair of agents, and although they do have a marriage and they do have kids, there is no love in this marriage. It's all for the mother country. But of course, the husband feels a little bit differently about their mission than she does, which of course leads to a bunch of tension in those first moments when you're first watching and getting to know these characters.
We're talking with Melanie McFarland about some of the new shows and how TV in its broadest sense is doing these days. So Fox also has this new Kevin Bacon TV show, a drama series. What's it called? The Following?
The Following.
Have you seen some of that yet?
I have.
You get
I've
to
seen...
see everything. You're like living in the future.
I do get to see a lot because there's so much television out there. I don't get to see everything. I did watch The Following because, of course, Kevin Bacon in a major role on television on a major network is a big deal.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if The Following is going to be a couple of years too late, simply because it is about a serial killer, and we are now many seasons into Dexter on Showtime. Smaller audience, but again, DVDs kind of catch people up with that. In this, he plays an FBI agent, a former FBI agent, who, of course, has the lovely pairing of a personal problem and a physical problem, which made him quit his job.
What's his physical problem? Or is that a surprise? I don't want to wreck it for anybody.
No, it's. I don't think it's that big of a spoiler. He has a bad heart, and he also has a drinking problem. And part of the reason
those can be problematic together,
together, it's not good. He made his case by catching a killer, a serial killer, who was inspired by Edgar Allan Poe. That character is played by James Purefoy.
Huh.
And although he was imprisoned, he discovers that the serial killer has developed a following of other serial killers through social media. And so the So the game renews. Now, of course, explaining that makes it sound like an incredibly silly series. And who knows, you know, a few weeks from now, once it's aired, people may say this is indeed one of the silliest things I've ever seen. That said, Fox is still the network of 24, which went on for years and years. And I would argue is one of the silliest TV series known to man.
Did you watch it?
Way too much of it. After a while, though, I just said, I can't take this
anymore. That was exactly what happened to me, too.
But I think that the thing about The Following is that it is incredibly dark, especially the pilot. And if you look at the series that are really getting people's attention now, I mean, on network, one of the biggest hits is Once Upon a Time, which is all about fairy tale characters.
Who casts spells and do damage to each other, right?
Yes, but we're not talking about casting spells and doing damage is a little bit different than having some really brutal kills that are shown fairly explicitly.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a big question. It might be a little too dark for network.
I was watching Criminal Minds. That's a CBS show, right? That's a pretty dark show.
It's a very dark show. I actually have not watched Criminal Minds for quite some time I think because there's only Criminal Minds to me is one of those shows that I've called before economy car television. It kind of gets you from point A to point B. You always know what you're going to get. And I think there's too much good television on right now. Now, some people will be like, hey, Criminal Minds is a great show. And you know what? I am not going to argue with you because if you're a fan of that show, more power to you.
I love that phrase, economy car television.
And I own an economy car, people.
Don't
get me wrong.
All right. Here's a clip. I want to ask you about some more shows. Here's a clip from Justified.
Stake your business.
Leave you so much as flinch. We're going to put you down.
Don't matter to me.
It's a war. People have been killed.
Don't shoot them unless it seems appropriate.
There ain't no salvation for people like us.
You think you get all your turmoil from me?
I am a deputy U.S. Marshal.
I'm a criminal.
Could be some gunplay involved.
Boy, Fox does have a lot of shows. They have Justified, too.
Yes, that's FX, actually.
FX, rather.
Yeah.
Sorry, FX.
But yeah, I think Justified is one of those shows that has these amazing... First of all, Raylan Givens, Timothy Oliphant, is wonderful in this character. I just love the way that he's adopted this kind of modern-day marshal persona. He's really developed it well over its run.
Though it felt pretty whole in the first episodes.
It absolutely did. I think the first episodes, just to kind of prove its point, there was a lot more gunplay. He shot a lot more people down during that first season, just to prove that Raylan is a fast draw. I think that the series really came into its own with the second season with Margot Martindale as Mags Bennett. And that was an amazing season with the Bennett clan.
Mm-hmm.
She, of course, won several awards for that,
yeah.
And rightfully so.
Do you feel that you're seeing the kind of writing that we would not have expected in television? Or maybe, I don't know. Are we in a golden age of writing for TV right now?
I think we have been for quite some time.
For quite some time.
I would say that it really started with The Sopranos. And
okay.
My colleague and friend Alan Sepinwall has written a wonderful book called The Revolution Will Be Televised. I'm hoping I got that title right. and he would probably even argue he's been analyzing episodes of television since NYPD Blue. But really, the golden age of television really kind of kicked into high gear with The Sopranos and with everything that HBO is doing. But I think that Justified is a wonderful piece of that in two ways. One, you have Graham Yost, who's one of the best producers working in television. You know, he worked on Band of Brothers and an amazing, many amazing series after that. And you also have Elmore Leonard. The character was based on Elmore Leonard. And if you really listen to the dialogue, there's a lot of cues of Elmore Leonard's style in there. He is a producer on the show.
Is that rubbing off? Is that moving into mainstream television? Whatever we mean by that anymore. I don't know what I mean by that. Old school networks, that kind of writing?
So you mean broadcast versus cable?
Yeah.
I think that there's more
premium.
I think that there's still more freedom on cable. That said, if you look at some network series, they've really adopted that freedom and really taken creative freedom to new levels on network. Sometimes it's worked very well. Sometimes it hasn't. If you look at a show like Parenthood, for instance, on NBC, very small audience, but it's a very well-written show. a lot of people joke, and it's true, that it makes you cry a lot, but it's not because it's a tearjerker in a cheap way. It really rings true, and I think that a lot of that is because they allow the writers a lot of freedom. Now, there are also fine writing on television that might not pass a higher standard. So I think that...
What's that? Do you have an example of that?
Well, I mean, I think it's very telling that one of the biggest hits, new hit series of this season is Revolution. Revolution is basically a weekly kind of blockbuster movie title on television.
Isn't it kind of the... I haven't seen it, but isn't it kind of the Hunger Games?
No. The premise of it is that one day the lights all go out and eventually militias are formed. And there's one particular militia, the Monroe Militia, that dissolves the United States and essentially takes away weapons from everyone except for militia members. And it's a very ruthless, very Wild West environment.
Huh. Man, that flew. All right. Here's a little clip from this is from Girls.
You destroyed my heart. Thanks.
This is what happens when you break up with a sociopath. This opens up space in my life for the kind, sexy, responsible boyfriend that I've always wanted but never had.
I've never understood your infatuation with him.
Adam is still crazy about me, and I know that I always said he was murdery in a sexy way, but what if he's murdery in, like, a murder way?
This is an HBO show, second season. Do you like this show?
I do. It really grew on me. I love the idea that it's kind of the true post Sex and the City inheritor for HBO. I don't think that these characters are necessarily likable all the time. But I do love the way that they kind of embrace being kind of broken and marginally employed in this very kind of deadpan way.
I've said here, Bored to Death, that's not been renewed, right?
No, that's
show. Oh,
that
well.
Is now gone.
Now gone.
Yes.
I'll have to watch reruns. All right. Now we only got to a few of the ones that we were going to talk about, Melanie McFarlane. So perhaps we could do this again.
I would love to do it again.
Because I will admit, I like television.
It's okay to admit you watch television.
I watch it.
You can read books, too.
I do both. I can do it on the same device now.
There you go.
Brody says, have you seen Downton Arby's? Great spoof. Rick is excited for 206, which is on King 5 Saturday night. Keister and Cashman back together.
Oh, that's great.
Call the Midwife on PBS. Great
excellent
show.
Excellent series.
That one writer suggests as well. All right.
I would also say, if I can really quickly, if you can go on Hulu, if you're a Downton Abbey fan and a Colbert fan, they actually did a nice skit called Breaking Abbey. So check that out.
Okay.
It's a mixture of Breaking Bad and Downton Abbey.
Oh, that's
priceless.
I'd like to see that. All right. And we'll go out with a little clip from the new season of Portlandia. Melanie McFarland is the TV editor at IMDb. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Bryce Shivers.
Hi, I'm Lisa Eversman.
And we put birds on things. Today we're going to go to a store on Mississippi Avenue. Nothing has birds on it, but you know what we're going to do? We're going to put birds on things.
Spruce it up. Make it pretty.
Put a bird on it.
What a sad little tote bag. I know, I'll put a bird on it. Did you see this bag before? I didn't. Now there's a bird. It's flying. It's free.
Good morning, it's 10:40. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. We have sunny skies and 40 degrees in the U District. We're expecting sun all day, the high getting up to 43. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of showers, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow, chance of rain in the morning, the high in the mid-40s.
Lisa O'Donnell says her new book is appropriate for some 15-year-olds, but certainly a story about burying your parents in the backyard is shocking.
That's not a nice thing to say, but young girls do fantasize about the absence of their own parents, wishing they weren't around.
The Death of Bees is the title of Lisa O'Donnell's book, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That comes your way Sunday morning from 5 until 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the Bush School, where students are challenged to reach beyond the conventional expectations of learning to use their education to make a difference in the world. K-12 open house in January. More information at bush.edu.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Do you like that sound that Orson Welles has, that radio announcer sound? Katie Sewell and I were thinking about what it was like to be a radio announcer during the great golden age of radio. Did you want to be an announcer?
No. And generally speaking, people in the golden age of radio didn't want to be announcers either. That was not a job that people set out to do. But it was a job that a lot of people did well.
I think that's interesting. In reading that, you found that out? This is a job they didn't want, huh?
Yeah. Well, interesting. So, Steve, when you think of a radio announcer, I mean, you can picture Andy, our radio announcer. But what do you picture in your head from, like, what a golden age radio announcer looks like?
Andy, our very handsome Andy, in a suit and tie and one hand up to his ear.
Yep. Often in a little tiny booth in front of a vintage microphone. It's not actually that inaccurate an image. In a lot of things like Laugh-In or shows like that, they use that as a joke of what a radio announcer looks like. But the reality of being a radio announcer actually was that, because you forget, we do a radio in very quiet studios right now. Back then, the announcer would be standing next to an orchestra.
Wow.
And so if they didn't have their hand over their ear, they couldn't even hear themselves. I read when I was researching this that some announcers would even grab onto their tie because the orchestra would be so loud that the tie would reverberate in their voices while they were talking over the music.
Very cool.
So just to put that image in your head, I just thought we'd hear an announcer talking over an orchestra and imagine how loud that would have been.
Yes, it's Maxwell House Coffee Time, starring George Burns and Gracie Allen. With yours truly, Bill Goodwin, the music of Meredith Wilson and his orchestra. For your Thursday night comedy enjoyment, it's George and Gracie. And for your everyday coffee drinking enjoyment, it's Maxwell House, the coffee that's always good to the last drop.
I have to say, putting that image in my head as you did of him being next to that orchestra changes it entirely.
I know, it's amazing that we've listened to these shows for years and I've never considered how loud it would have been to have the orchestra in the room.
Wow, that's crazy. All right, so...
Announcers. Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't like their jobs because I thought guys like, you know, like Don Wilson with Jack Benny, they liked being that persona.
Well, I think Don Wilson did like his experience with Jack Benny because Jack Benny wrapped him into the show and... would take him on trips with him a lot of the time. But a lot of announcers, when they came to be in radio, wanted to be something else. Don Wilson wanted to be a singer, for instance. Most of them wanted to be actors.
Sure.
So announcer Fred Foy, who worked for WXYZ in Detroit, eventually landed this job.
A fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty high old silver, the Lone Ranger.
Pretty prolific.
Yeah,
that's great. That announcing job. And good for him, for a person who wanted to be an actor in radio instead of an announcer. He also became the understudy for the show's star, Bruce Beamer, but he only got to fill in one time.
Is that right?
On March 29th, Bruce Beamer showed up in 1954, showed up at the studio with laryngitis, and Fred Foy was ready to go. Here he is playing the lead.
Mister, if you two came to rob us...
We're not outlaws.
I don't know who you are, but you sure came...
He's the Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger? This is my foreman, Tex.
Howdy.
I'm Jack Fairfield.
Oh, yes. Oh, Tex, if you'll cover those outlaws, Tonto will bandage their wounds while I look after the one who saved Mr. Fairfield.
Right. I'll get the guns and watch him.
This man is alive but unconscious, but I'm sure he'll be all right. I'll loosen his collar.
That's great.
It's a pretty good impression. Just for the people who don't actually know what Bruce Beamer sounded like as the Lone Ranger, I thought we'd play a clip of what the real actor sounded like.
Oh, we're not outlaws.
Whoever you are, you're meddling in army business.
Sergeant McQuaid, we overheard your conversation.
Then you know I'm acting on orders, so go on about your business.
There may be serious consequences if you carry out those orders.
You tell that to Colonel Wade.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's pretty close.
Yeah. Very close.
Announcers were partly hired for their richness of voice and how well that they were able to be clear and, you know, direct. And so when it came to the delivery of Bruce Beamer, who is actually that way, him as an announcer filling in, Fred Foy did a pretty good job.
You know, you reminded me of something, if I may share a personal story.
Oh, please do.
My father was in radio for a time in the early 30s. He lived in Chicago. And he went up to Wisconsin and got a job, he told us, in, I'm pretty sure it was in Milwaukee, though I may be making that up. But he worked as an announcer, doing acting and as an announcer in some of those shows. And he also got some bit parts in Chicago, though it was much harder to get in Chicago. One of the people that he was competing with who was successful was Hugh Downs, who he saw on an elevator at CBS in Chicago, WBBM, going up the elevator, and he was going down. They were competing for a part.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've never heard and hit my dad on the radio, though, and this conversation makes me wonder if any tapes like that exist.
Let's dig around. We'll do that radio retrospective on your father.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Well, it is true, from what I've read, that any announcer would drop any regular gig to get it, to do like a little temporary gig as an actor. It was that important to them, in general speaking, except for, if I may, announcer Jackson Beck, who became very well known for this introduction.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
It's a plane. It's Superman.
Yes, it's Superman, brought to you by that super delicious cereal, Kellogg's Pep.
Kellogg's Pep.
I just thought I'd leave a little of the ad, just for fun.
I wonder who at Kellogg's Pep was like, if any of you folks ate Kellogg's Pep.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. I'm sure they did. I was startled, actually, in hearing that ad. I should have maybe left the whole thing in, that it was exactly the same kind of advertising that I had when I was a kid about the importance of eating breakfast and how now that it's not summertime, it's probably a little harder get all your vitamins in.
There have been many stories and many novels about the fact that really... 20th century culture began when 20th century radio started to really understand how we could be sold all sorts of things. All right, so
to Jackson.
Yeah.
So he gives up acting. He originally wants to be an actor. He says, I've proven that I can act to people. And he decides he wants to be an announcer. And the way he put it was, he says, a character man always comes and goes, but the announcer is there every day.
Huh.
And he wanted to work every day. But eventually, you know, he did go back to being an actor, which is interesting.
He became the Cisco Kid?
Yep.
Jackson Beck played the Cisco Kid?
Yes. That's the job he ends up getting, and so he goes from being an announcer to being a lead. Let's hear him as that.
Was it you who killed Senor Trask or Lynch?
It was him.
I thought so. You would not have the nerve.
You can't prove it. Nobody will believe you.
Cisco,
Yes, senor, he's right. We not can prove it. So why we not kill him to learn him a lesson? And then we go get supper, huh?
It's a good idea, Pancho. But if we kill him, then there is nobody to tell the judge that Lynch did the murder.
But he not tell anyway. No reason to let him live.
The senor is a brave man. He will die to protect his friend.
Hey, now, wait a minute. Now,
I salute your courage, senor.
Boy, there's a bit of radio that probably wouldn't fly today. All right, so good announcers, they were rare.
Well, no, good announcers weren't rare. There were a lot of really great announcers of that period, but it was rare for them to become an actor like he was.
I see.
Generally speaking, if you became an announcer, you became an announcer. And yeah. Especially if you were, you know, hawking some sort of brand, because oftentimes, like, anchor hawking glass would be, that's my man, you know?
That's the guy.
Yeah, and they wouldn't really want to let you go.
Huh.
So.
What's this thing that Ken Miles said?
Well,
this is a mid-40s announcer?
Yeah, and he was a mid-40s announcer, and
Ken Miles.
He was giving advice to young announcers that were starting up, who were asking him about what they should be doing. And he said, voice quality is important, technique is a must, but above all, you must be natural, sincere, and friendly. And that's what it takes to be a good announcer.
Very nice. All right. I think I have to go out with War's rendition of the Cisco Kid, if you don't mind.
If you'd like.
Because it reminded me of it. This is Weekday. Kind of went full circle there, didn't we? Music, radio, and there was television, because the Cisco Kid was on TV as well. Now it's time for lunch, or almost. Sarah Dickerman, who writes about food and the food universe at the New York Times, at Slate, at other places, joins us to talk about lunch recommendations and other issues. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm very good, and I'm getting ready for the new year, and let's talk about your project in Bon Appetit, because you have a whole effort here, the Food Lovers Cleanse.
Yes. It's one of my big projects every year. It's the third year I've done it now. And don't let the word cleanse scare you. It doesn't involve eating cayenne pepper and lemon water for days or anything like that. It's really about trying to reboot your habits in the kitchen for the new year and cooking with healthier ingredients and finding the deliciousness in those healthy ingredients, because I really have no interest in eating anything that's healthy but not tasty.
So you and nutritionist Marissa Lippert for BonAppetit.com came up with, so what is, I love this picture here on the what is the Food Lover's Cleanse. You have beets, you have squash, you have sweet potato, cucumber, piece of salmon. What are you thinking?
So what we try to do is emphasize ingredients that we should be eating more of proportionally within our diet. So that includes lots and lots of produce, which is harder to do in the winter, I'll admit, than in the summer when you have, you know, farmers markets with strawberries and peaches and cucumbers everywhere. So part of it is just finding those great winter seasonal ingredients, storage vegetables, some tropical fruits that come in particularly good shape, citrus fruit that's in great shape now, and learning how to work with those and really finding the pleasures of those, which, you know, once again, we're emphasizing flavor, but then, of course, that ups your fiber that you're eating. It ups the vitamins and minerals you're eating. It tends to decrease the amount of refined starches that you're eating, which are not on the plan.
Tell me how you made
no white flour throughout the 2 weeks.
No white flour?
Nope. Yeah.
Tell me how you made a kale salad with tuna and white beans especially tasty.
Well, that's a simple, you know, pretty quick salad. I always, tuna and beans is my shortcut lunch whenever I don't have time to go out to one of the many delightful restaurants in our city. I often have a nice West Coast canned tuna in my pantry and a can of beans, or I'll make up a batch of beans. And then just toss the tuna and the beans together with a little homemade sherry vinaigrette. It's delicious. And then in this case, we added a lot of kale, which has that nice sort of minerally bite. And kale is so hot right now. I don't know whether you know this, but kale was like the food trend of 2012.
I do. And all the different, and what I think was remarkable is how many different kales there are and how they taste different. And they're all so interesting.
I know. Funny, and it's so absurd that it's trendy, but it is. It's a very nice vegetable, so we like to work with it. I should add that throughout the whole plan, there's recipes for every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then Kimberly Hasselbrink, who's a really talented photographer, took photographs of everything. So there's beautiful, sort of inspiring pictures to egg you on.
And so what's the plan? You do this for 14 days, and that just sort of jumpstarts your thinking about healthy foods?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helps you get rid of a couple bad habits for 2 weeks, and then sometimes maybe they don't creep in so quickly again. So that means I want to make sure that it's inspiring people and making them realize, oh my gosh, yeah, the pomegranates are amazing right now. Why not sprinkle those on top of a butternut squash and shiitake mushroom stew, or put them in my salad just to make it a little more interesting and a little less dreary.
That sounds great.
You know, even if you're working with a corporate salad bar, as I know many of you are, you know, if you bring some pomegranate seeds and sprinkle them on your salad, it's a little more fun and a little more delicious. So that can help you stick to the straight and narrow. We're also emphasizing healthy fats, so that includes yummy things like walnuts, pumpkin seeds, and oily fish like salmon, and I don't think I have any mackerel in this year's plan, but salmon, mackerel, black cod, all are great ingredients to work with.
I like the looks of your butternut squash and tomato soup.
That is a yummy one, and quite easy. You have to roast this. You know, you roast the squash in halves. But then once you've roasted the squash, it just all goes in the blender, and you've got a nice amount of soup that you could, again, you know, carry some into work and put in the microwave, and easy peasy.
All right. So that's at bonappetit.com. We have links as well at kuow.org. Keeping that in mind, what's a restaurant suggestion?
Well, this is a fun one. Sometimes if you want a little, I don't do a full on juice cleanse. As I said, I like to work with whole foods, but you know, every now and then when I'm feeling a little low, either I'm low on energy and I'm a little sick, or I just feel like something that tastes really, really healthy, I do like to get a good juice. I remember the old days of the Gravity Bar on Broadway, and that always seemed like such a cool place. I don't know whether anyone remembers that. But anyway,
in the market, too.
Yeah, there's a new juice bar now that opened, I think, over the course of the summer, and they were at the Broadway Market, and they were just making the most delicious and appealing juices, and now they have moved inside La Bette Restaurant, yet another one of those sort of shops within a shop situations. It's called Juice Box, and they do really terrific, it's two chefs who run the place, and they really have a chef's eye towards what tastes good together. There's nothing that tastes like compost in this juice bar. It's all really fresh, interesting combinations. Right now in the winter, they're working with a fair amount of tropical fruit combined with vegetables. So one of the juices I've had there that I really loved was a lacinato kale, which is that Tuscan kale, the sort of bumpy one, with pineapple juice, which adds obviously sweetness and a little bit of acid, celery, and coconut water. And it's just really refreshing. And it feels very wholesome, and it gives you a boost. They also are combining blood orange juice with carrot juice and a little bit of turmeric root, which is, you've probably used turmeric if you've ever cooked an Indian curry, but we usually see it in powder form. And here they're using the fresh turmeric, which has this really beautiful golden hue. And it's got a little kind of bitterness, and it's a very distinct quality, but it actually used in combination with something sweet like orange juice is totally delicious.
That sounds great. That's the Juice Box. You can also find Sarah Dickerman's BonAppetit.com cleanse at the BonAppetit.com site and also at KUOW.org. Sarah, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
And we'll talk to you folks again tomorrow. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
Good morning, it's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets. PCC embraces the winter season with organic Rio Star grapefruit, fresh winter greens, and hearty soups with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.